Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The shooting of Michael Brown, an unarmed 18-year-old black teenager in Ferguson, Missouri, on August 9, 2014, by a since-retired white Ferguson, Missouri police officer, Darren Wilson, is the subject of this, the first of two Radio Curious interviews devoted to this topic. Our guest is law professor James A. Cohen, who has tried over 100 criminal jury trials and teaches criminal law and related topics at Fordham University Law School in New York City, New York. Professor Cohen and I review the spoken testimony, the written police and medical reports presented to the St. Louis, Missouri grand jury by District Attorney Robert McCullough. His office exclusively organized and presented that evidence, which, with some exceptions, according to Prosecutor McCullough, was made public shortly after he announced that the grand jury failed to return criminal charges against former Officer Wilson on November 24, 2014. All the evidence presented to this grand jury is available online, with links at radiocurious.org. When Professor Cohen and I visited by phone on December 5, 2014, we created a context for what occurred when the Ferguson grand jury met between August 20 and November 21, 2014. We began our conversation with a brief history of grand juries, originally organized in England to protect the people from wanton acts of the king.
The grand jury came into existence in England as an attempt to buffer some of the decisions of the crown. It was initially, in that context, often thought to be the protector of individual rights. It would deliberate, it would hear some evidence in advance of the king's making a decision.
So bringing that forward now to the 21st century in the United States, how has it morphed?
It's both morphed and not morphed in a number of different ways. One, we did take it almost wholesale from the English, as we have so many other things. In most jurisdictions, it is pretty much in the same condition as it was in England when it first began. It has morphed in the sense that we obviously don't have a crown here. It is no longer considered a bulwark or protector of citizens' rights against the power of the government. It is occasionally referred to in that context because that's the historical context in which it came about, and we have trouble shaking that. There are some jurisdictions that no longer have a grand jury because they said it serves no purpose any longer. For the most part, the government is not out to get any particular individual or group, although that may be put into some question now.
Tell us the typical procedure that is followed in the presentation of evidence to the grand jury.
The grand jury is part of our federal constitution. And in the federal system, as is the case in many state systems, 23 individuals are called to the courthouse, and they are asked very few questions. It is explained to them that the task of a grand juror is different than the task of a trial juror because the standard of proof is so much less. They are asked whether or not they can be present on some sort of regular basis. Grand jurors typically do not sit day in, day out, week in, week out. They will sit for a period of time, but not every day. They are sworn to decide the matter impartially and to keep the matter secret.
The information that's given to them is by the district attorney to establish evidence that a crime was committed.
And the person who committed it. And it's to establish evidence at a probable cause level, which is the lowest standard we have in our law.
With probable cause being the lowest level of proof, let's define what probable cause is.
Probable cause means that the evidence shows it is more probable than not that a crime occurred, and of course you have to have an instruction on a crime, and it is more probable than not that a specific individual committed that crime. it is a very, very low standard.
Then let's jump ahead to what people perhaps may be more familiar with, guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and determine that difference.
The contrast is quite striking, and we don't talk much in general about a grand jury, so most of us know something about a trial jury. In a trial jury, the prosecutor is obligated to present competent evidence, which is a distinction between what may be presented at a grand jury, competent evidence that proves the guilt of the accused beyond a reasonable doubt. That is the highest standard of proof that we have in our system.
So the question is, what is it beyond a reasonable doubt? What does that mean?
Well, that's a question for the ages. Some people like to put it in terms of percentages. Courts don't generally like that. Courts try to avoid giving a very specific definition because over time, courts have found that either lawyers will unfairly manipulate whatever standard is given and or jurors will misunderstand. The concept is closely guarded but ill-defined.
Here in California, added to guilty beyond a reasonable doubt is the phrase to a moral certainty.
Some jurisdictions have the moral certainty language. It is not language that is approved in either federal court or in the state of New York.
So one of the things that I've done in closing arguments to juries is point out that to a moral certainty can be interpreted that tomorrow when you look yourself in the mirror after you've gotten up, will you know that you were right if you find my client guilty?
Yes, powerful argument. And I think that to the extent that the availability of a moral certainty charge, and then as you just described, the kinds of arguments that a lawyer, a defense lawyer, might make based on it, have increased the chances of acquittals.
What I'd like to do is narrow our conversation to what happened at the Ferguson grand jury discussion.
Okay, well, Barry, with your permission, I'd like to take just a half a step backwards. The process that was used in Ferguson, where the prosecutor both asserted at the very beginning that he intended to present all of the evidence that was available to the grand jury, and he also asserted at the beginning that he intended to release all of the evidence to the public, ended up, in my judgment, constituting a very cynical, deceptive way to proceed. When you examine the transcript, it comes out clearly and frequently that the prosecutors in this case were making every effort to paint Officer Wilson in the best possible light, in contrast to paint Mr. Brown and any witnesses that seemed to say something in his favor in the worst possible light. A good example right at the beginning is Officer Wilson's testimony itself. There was no cross-examination of Officer Wilson's testimony. There was no challenge in terms of did it really make sense? Was it consistent with the forensic evidence? The failure to challenge is inconsistent with the supposedly impartial role of the prosecutor. It was clear, as you read the transcript of the grand jury and as you think about it, it's clear that the prosecutors in this case in Ferguson were on a mission. And the mission was to accomplish the goal of making sure that Officer Wilson, in the first place, was not indicted for a murder charge. And in the second place, in the very, very unlikely event that the grand jury in this case became what we call a runaway grand jury, that the defense attorneys would have plenty of evidence and have it very, very early to make sure that Officer Wilson was not convicted at trial.
Is this a typical situation in your experience in grand juries where the potential defendant has an opportunity to present their position?
In most jurisdictions, the prospective defendant or the possible defendant is permitted to testify in the grand jury. But most defense lawyers do not seriously consider putting their client in the grand jury because it gives the prosecutor an opportunity to cross-examine, to make it crystal clear what the defendant's or putative defendant's statements are, so you as a prosecutor get to nail down those statements so that if they are changed in any way, the prosecutor in a trial context can claim that the change is proof that the witness is lying. So it's unusual, although they have the right, it's unusual for defendants or putative defendants to testify in the grand jury. And when they do, it's unusual for a prosecutor to not take the opportunity to make the record as tight as possible and also to cross-examine the witness on the story that he is telling.
So what is your take on the reason why the district attorney, Robert McCullough, did not cross-examine Officer Wilson on the events of that day?
It seems very clear from the transcript and from Prosecutor McCullough's statements even before that he, the prosecutor, had concluded that Officer Wilson had not done anything criminal. And that's not unusual, all right? It's not unusual at all for prosecutors when there's a claim of police misconduct, typically excessive force. It's not at all unusual for prosecutors to, in effect, side with the police officer. And it's clear to me that this was done in this case, notwithstanding the prosecutor's public claims to the contrary.
When you say it was clear to you in this case, what stands out?
Well, there's a number of things that stand out. So let me give you some examples, big and small, from a trial lawyer's perspective, because I've tried a whole lot of cases. One example is the fact that the prosecutors in this case called to testify the senior person in the Ferguson Police Department who arrived at the scene shortly after the shooting. And they asked a series of questions of that officer about Officer Wilson. Not Officer Wilson in terms of what he did or did not do that day or what he did say or did not say that day. They asked those questions, too. But about Officer Wilson's job performance, about his character as a police officer. So you have a series of questions eliciting what a good police officer Officer Wilson was. Had he ever discharged his gun? Not to my knowledge, the witness testified. A series of questions like that. Now, that's before Officer Wilson testifies. That is what we call in the law bolstering. You bolster the target, quote-unquote target's to-be testimony, by setting it up in such a way that you provide the whole context. So the listener, the grand jurors, will now be of the mind, at least in terms of information, once this sergeant testified that Officer Wilson is a good cop, he's a nonviolent cop, never discharged his weapon. He's a calm, peaceful, competent police officer. And it's against that backdrop that Officer Wilson gets to testify. Right? It's in a trial context, it's illegal. A judge would sustain the objection and strike the testimony if any had come out.
In this case, in the sequence of the grand jury in Ferguson, where was the testimony of Officer Wilson?
Officer Wilson testified pretty early on, as did the sergeant who bolstered his upcoming testimony. And that in and of itself, I should say the timing of Officer Wilson's testimony is unusual, because Officer Wilson was clearly the one who had engaged in conduct. The question for the grand jury was whether that conduct was justified at a grand jury level, at a probable cause level, or not. And what usually happens in cases where there's a claim of police misconduct and the police officer wants to testify, which in most cases they really have to do to have a chance of getting out from under, the prosecutor won't put that witness in the grand jury until very close to the end of the proceedings. And again, the fact that the prosecutor let or called Officer Wilson early on strongly suggests to me that this whole thing was a foregone conclusion.
And that was the intention of the prosecutor.
Yes, there's no question that that's accurate.
I want to know more from you about the testimony of the other individuals who testified before the Ferguson grand jury. But before we get there, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Professor James A. Cohen, who is a professor of law at Fordham University Law School in Manhattan, New York. We're talking about the testimony that was presented to the grand jury investigating the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Jim, what is some of the other evidence that you can tell us about that is noteworthy that was presented to the grand jury?
Officer Wilson testified, and he gave, as part of his testimony, he gave a very, very vivid and, in my judgment, moving account of what happened when Mr. Brown sort of tried to get into the car, tried to get his gun, meaning Officer Wilson's gun, when Mr. Brown was striking Officer Wilson about the head and neck. And, in fact, at one point, Officer Wilson said, "I feared for my life. I feared that if Mr. Brown were able to land another blow, it would kill me." So that was moving. It was vivid. It was shocking. And Prosecutor McCullough made it clear when he made his presentation that the grand jury's decision was not simply based upon the testimony of witnesses, but it was based upon forensic evidence. And part of that forensic evidence was a whole lot of photographs that were taken of Officer Wilson very soon after this event, which is standard practice.
What did those photographs reveal?
Well, not too much. And that's really an illustration in my mind of where the prosecutor failed to do his duty of impartiality and cross-examine Officer Wilson. The photographs show slight reddish discoloring in places on the face and around the neck. You don't see anything that appeared to be a lump in the sense that somebody had been struck. And as the body does, there's a lump that's formed because of the trauma to that particular location. You don't see any cuts at all. There's no blood. So you see reddish discoloring, which certainly could not have been fun for Officer Wilson, but it's in some significant contrast to the officer's vivid description of being beaten and that he, Officer Wilson, was in fear for his life. So that's an example where the prosecutor ought to have at least confronted Officer Wilson with the disconnect between the photographs and his testimony and asked Officer Wilson if he could explain that disconnect.
Where on Officer Wilson's head were these strikes shown to have taken place?
There were some marks on his cheek and towards his chin, and there were also some marks around his neck, including the back of his neck. And when I say marks, I'm talking about the discoloration, the reddish discoloration.
It's important here to note, Jim, that a review of the evidence that was presented to the Ferguson grand jury, all of which is available on the Radio Curious website, radiocurious.org, shows that the blemishes to Officer Wilson's face were on the right side of his face. That means that while Officer Wilson was sitting in his squad car, he would have had to shift his body to the left and make the right side of his face available to be struck by Michael Brown, who was alleged to be outside of Officer Wilson's car at that time. This was not brought out in the testimony, nor was Officer Wilson questioned about this.
I think that's an entirely fair question, but I do note that the officer spends some time and emotion describing how big Mr. Brown was, how he, Brown, was sort of all over him, how he, Wilson, felt as if he were a toy in the hands of Hulk Hogan. Again, that part of the description seems a little bit at odds, more than a little bit at odds, with the fact that Officer Wilson is, I think, also 6'4", although he's not as heavy as Mr. Brown was at the time.
And he was also in his squad car.
Yes. And in his squad car, there ought to have been the usual accoutrements of police officers, which is a baton and a radio and other things. There are some arguable disconnects there that the prosecutor, in my judgment, intentionally failed to follow up on. It is also perfectly clear that Officer Wilson was very well prepared to testify. Now, when I say that, I don't say it critically, and I would be very, very surprised if the prosecutors in any way played a role in preparing Officer Wilson to testify. But they were really unnecessary, because I think Officer Wilson not only was represented by an attorney, but probably by more than one, and they had gone over his testimony as they expected it to be numerous times. The other thing, by the way, that was surprising to me was the fact that unless you have sort of a predetermined goal that you have as a prosecutor, it was surprising to me that the prosecutor brought up any prior statement that Officer Wilson had made, because he clearly did so in an effort to show that all of Officer Wilson's statements were consistent. And that, of course, was not the form that the examination of the other witnesses took. Indeed, there was an effort with respect to the other witnesses to show the inconsistencies among their statements, both among the individual witnesses and among multiple statements by individuals.
Well, let's direct our attention to who those other witnesses were and what they said.
Okay, well, one witness that I just actually looked at was the individual who apparently was a friend or at least an acquaintance of Mr. Brown, who was with him in that convenience store and who was walking on the street with him. And the prosecutors did, in fact, cross-examine him and did make certain to highlight several different things. One of the things that they highlighted was the claim, at least, that this particular witness maybe did not see exactly what he said he saw. Now, I want to pause here for a minute. There's nothing inappropriate in a prosecutor doing that in a grand jury context. It's entirely appropriate for the prosecutor to make sure that witnesses are testifying about what they saw or heard or did, and more importantly, don't give a different impression to the grand jury. It's entirely appropriate. The question in my mind is, why wasn't that done with Officer Wilson? The prosecutor has a duty, as much as possible, and considering the burden of proof, to make sure that the evidence that is presented to the grand jury is accurate. So in that role, the prosecutor was acting entirely appropriately to make sure that the witness was not overspeaking, that the witness was not mistaken in any way, that the witness was not saying things that, in fact, the witness didn't mean to say. But it ought to have been done with Officer Wilson as well.
Why was it not done with Officer Wilson?
It was not done with Officer Wilson because Prosecutor McCullough had decided that this was not conduct, that Wilson's conduct was not conduct that deserved a criminal charge. And from that decision, every effort was made to make sure that the grand jury would not return an indictment.
What do you believe, or what do you opine, is the basis for his decision?
Well, let me just answer your question directly. I believe the basis for McCullough's decision was his genuine belief that Officer Wilson was in danger, at least during parts of this episode, and that because he was in danger, he did not deserve to have an indictment. But this case illustrates why that's problematic, why it's problematic for an individual to draw that conclusion before all the evidence is in, even at the grand jury level. One of the things that became, I thought, startling from the transcript and startling from subsequent events, that is, when Officer Wilson was exonerated, if you will, or there was no true bill, and he went on, I think it was ABC News, and said, I would have done the same thing, I did no wrong, I had no choice. I had to do what I did. What Officer Wilson did is he got out of the car, and he went after Brown. This is a guy who had just been, according to his own testimony, in fear for his life and severely beaten. Backup had been called, but Officer Wilson decided not to wait for it, even though it's very clear, at least in retrospect, that the wait would have been a very short wait. The streets were in a bit of a tempest at the time. There were people on the streets. The notion that Officer Wilson felt that the only thing he could do was get out of his car and, in effect, chase down Brown seems to me to be ridiculous. And I think what it stems from, what his motivation stemmed from, is that he, Officer Wilson, had just been subjected to a beatdown. And he, Officer Wilson, was not going to take that. All right, cops become cops for a reason. And one of the reasons is that they don't tolerate being beaten up or being beaten easily. And I think that's the primary explanation for why Officer Wilson went after Brown at that point, as opposed to waiting for a minute, maybe a minute and a half, until reinforcements arrived, and then calmly identifying Brown again. Don't forget, Brown is on videotape at that convenience store. It's not a very large community. So it's ludicrous to me to think that if Officer Wilson had not given chase at that moment, Mr. Brown would never have been called to answer for his crimes, including the alleged assault on Wilson. It just doesn't make any sense at all. Some people think, well, you know, a police officer gives you an order and you disobey it at your peril. And that certainly is a strong and clear belief in the black community. But the fact of the matter is, assuming the worst about Brown, that he did assault Wilson, and that he did steal and rough up the store owner at the convenience store, none of those offenses are penalized or sanctioned by the death penalty. And that's what Wilson did, without any process whatsoever, and now without any serious grand jury process.
Well, Professor James Cohen, I'd like to thank you for being with us on part one of this edition of Radio Curious, where we're discussing the grand jury process in Ferguson, Missouri, centering on the death of Michael Brown and the shots that were shot into his body by Officer Darren Wilson. You have just heard the first of a two-part interview regarding the Ferguson, Missouri shooting death of Michael Brown, in which no legal action was taken against the white police officer who killed him. Our guest is Professor James A. Cohen, who has tried over 100 criminal jury trials and teaches criminal law and related topics at Fordham University Law School in New York City. The books that Professor Cohen recommends are those written by Anders Ericsson, The Road to Excellence, The Acquisition of Expert Performance in Arts and Sciences, Sports and Games, and Development of Professional Expertise Towards Measurement of Expert Performance and Design of Optical Learning Environments. This interview, the first of a two-part series, was recorded on December 5th. 2014. There are over 500 archive editions of Radio Curious on our website, www.radiocurious.org, where they're free for you to stream, download, enjoy, and share. We appreciate your curiosity, ideas, comments, and questions. You may reach us by email, curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our associate producer, and I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.